For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right. Let's look at the passing of the baton. This is 2 Kings 2, verse 1. It says, when the Lord was about to take Elijah up to heaven in a whirlwind, Elijah and Elisha were traveling from Gilgal. And Elijah said to Elisha, stay here, for the Lord has told me to go to Bethel. But Elisha replied, as surely as the Lord lives and you yourself live, I will never leave you. And so they went up together to Bethel. The group of prophets from Bethel came to Elisha and asked him, did you know that the Lord is going to take your master away from you today? Of course I know, Elisha answered, but be quiet about it. He's annoyed. Then in verse 4, Elijah said to Elisha, stay here, for the Lord has called me to Jericho. So from Gilgal to Bethel to Jericho. But Elisha replied again, as surely as the Lord lives and you yourself live, I will never leave you. So the second time he said exactly the same thing. So they went on together to Jericho. Then the group of the prophets from Jericho came to Elisha and asked him, did you know that the Lord is going to take your master away from you today? And he says, of course I know, but be quiet about it. Then Elijah said to Elisha, stay here, for the Lord has told me to go to the Jordan River. But again, Elisha replied, as surely as the Lord lives and you yourself live, I will never leave you. And so they left together. So you see how incredibly redundant almost every verse in this narrative is. And it just focuses really our attention on this dynamic that exists between the older man Elijah, who had established himself as the kind of preeminent prophet in Israel now for decades, and his younger protege, Elisha, as they've now been together some 10 years. And so we want to just kind of pause for a second and think about that before we move into the meat of the story, because really what we're looking at here is a fairly painful transition, a painful transition specifically for Elisha, the younger man. Let's break it down a little bit. What we're seeing is really the end of an important era, not only in Israel's history, but in the biography of this younger man, Elisha. We had learned a couple of years ago that God had, a couple of weeks ago, singled out Elisha to be a partner for Elijah in his work. Remember, coming down after this massive confrontation in 1 Kings chapter 19 with the prophets of Baal. A deeply depleted Elijah is in a place of despair. And one of the things that God does for him is he says, I'm going to appoint your successor. And his name is Elisha, and he tells him where he's from and everything else. And so these two came together. And from the just the breakdown of the historical framework of the narrative, we know that for 10 years, wherever Elijah went, Elisha went with him. For 10 years, they had a role to play in Israel. They had a role to play to declare the reality about the one true God, the reality of Yahweh, their God, who had acted on their behalf in history, and how they had turned from the worship and faithfulness to this God to things that are not God, the Baals and all these other pagan deities. And so they had a work to do. They did it together. And they obviously, through this context, formed a very intimate bond with each other. And, you know, that bond is really an important kind of background to this text that we're studying here tonight. And it leaks out through that thrice repeated expression of Elisha that I will not leave you. As long as you're alive, as long as you're on this earth, I will not leave you. Because they had formed such an important partnership. They had seen so many things together that it just was inconceivable for Elisha that as long as Elijah had breath in his lungs, that they would be separated in some way. And I think that that is a really sweet kind of window into the sort of relationships that happen among spiritually minded people when they really are coming together with one purpose to serve God in their life. And it just happens that when we together as individuals, put God at the center of our relationship and what we're about, it just draws us nearer together, closer to one another. That's inevitably what happens, and it happens in relationships. It happens in marriage. You know, the solution to a good marriage isn't merely spending more time together or being interested in one another's worlds. Okay, that does matter. That's important. But it's to have something that is greater than yourself that both of you are all in for. And that's what really brings people together. And this is what they're experiencing here. And then lastly, that they had succeeded in their task. And it's evident because everywhere they're going, from Gilgal to Bethel to Jericho, they're meeting with communities of people, believers in the one true God, people who've sort of come out of the woodwork under the repressive treatment of Ahab and Jezebel. They're actually standing out, and they're defiant. Defiant that, no, we're not going to just go underground. There's work to be done. And so Elijah and Elisha, super effective in consolidating this community around whom Israel is going to be really restored in their faithfulness to God. That's the game plan. And so they have accomplished great things together. And Elisha is at this place in his life where it's just like he can't imagine what it will be like without Elijah at his side. And yet that's exactly where the narrative is going. Let's read on. He says in verse 7, 50 men from the group of the prophets also went out, and they watched at a distance as Elijah and Elisha stopped beside the Jordan River. Then Elijah folded his cloak together and stuck it in the water, and the river divided, and the two of them went across on dry ground. That's a weird event. We're going to have to come back to that. What's up with that? Verse 9, then they came to the other side. When they came to the other side, Elijah said to Elisha, "Tell me what I can do for you before I'm taken away." So that's a generous thought. Everyone knows that this is the last day that they're going to be together. It's been revealed to them that Elijah's time has come and that God is going to take him away. And so what do you ask, you know, of your mentor when this is like the last thing you're going to be ever able to ask him? He says, "Please let me inherit a double share of your spirit and to become your successor," which is a strange request on the one hand, because he already knows that he's Elijah's successor, because God's already said that that's the case. But the real focal point here seems to me to be that he has this insecurity, and he sees a strength in Elijah. He sees something in Elijah that he doesn't see in himself, a boldness, an uncompromising spirit, an ability to just look people in the eye and tell it the way it is. And so there's a certain level of timidity, I think, that we can assume at this stage of Elisha's life. And he's looking for strength from Elijah. And so he asks, "What I really want is a double portion of your spirit, because that's what I realize that I lack so poignantly in my own life." Well, it goes on. "You've asked a difficult thing," Elijah says. "If you see me when I'm taken from you, then you'll get your request. But if not, then you won't." So, not super reassuring, but kind of reassuring. Do you like your odds, you know? Well, as they were walking along and talking, suddenly a chariot of fire appeared, drawn by horses of fire. And it drove between the two men, separating them, and Elijah was carried by a whirlwind into heaven. Wow. That is such a wild scene. And so here's a guy who never died. And so you think about that for a second. He didn't die. He was taken up into heaven. If you're kind of cued into the whole Bible narrative, you realize, well, if he's not dead, he must still be around. And indeed he is. And so we see that he reappears. at a pivotal moment in Jesus Christ's own ministry, shortly before his death and resurrection, he is on what is called the Mount of Transfiguration. This closing moment in Jesus' ministry as he's prepared to go from this mountain down to Jerusalem, down to the cross, down to betrayal, down to pay for the sins of humanity. And who should meet him on that mountain? Moses and Elijah, testifying in front of the disciples and to Jesus himself. Yes, you are God's man. It's time to take your, to do, he says in Luke's accounting of this, to effect your exodus down to Jerusalem, down to the cross, to pay for the sins of humanity. The prophet Elijah is alive to speak to the reality of who Jesus is and will come at the end of the age as well. That's why Jewish people, even to this day, on their annual Seder, always reserve an empty seat for the prophet Elijah, who will come and precede the coming of the Messiah. We read on, verse 12, Elijah saw it and he cried out, my father, I see the chariots and the charioteers of Israel. And as they disappeared from sight, Elisha tore his clothes in distress. A sign of distress. You rip your clothes in agony. And then it says that Elisha picked up Elijah's cloak, which had fallen when he was taken up. Then Elisha returned to the bank of the Jordan River, and he stuck into the water Elijah's cloak, and he cried out, "Where is the Lord, the God of Israel?" In many translations, like this one, it's a question mark. Other translations seem to indicate, and I think it's probably accurate, that it's more of a declaration of fact. Where is the Lord, the God of Israel? In other words, he's expecting God to act. And indeed, God does act. Then the river divided, and Elisha went across. When the group of the prophets from Jericho saw at a distance what happened, they exclaimed, Elijah's spirit rests upon Elisha. And they went to meet him, and they bowed down to the ground before him. And so that's the end of our little narrative for tonight. It raises, I think, some really interesting facets of what leadership is all about. Four things that we'll kind of see from this story that provide the foundation for Elisha's leadership. And my hope is that we'll find ourselves in a place where we can connect with these four ideas, these things that we find in the text, and draw some real direct and poignant application to our own situation. Let's begin with the first, which is the calling of Elisha now into the work of into Elijah's shoes, and this passing of the baton from one generation to another. And so this is really the important thing that we need to understand about all things that people do to cooperate with what God is doing in the world, and which is that what you're doing is temporary. Whether it's a few years or many years, everyone's earthly desire and life of serving the Lord is going to come to an end. And so leadership does not go on forever. And so for that reason, and this is kind of an important point, some friends of ours many years ago at a mission organization that we use called World Team have this statement. They say, you know, what you need to do with leadership is begin with the end in mind. And I think that that's really great advice. You know, because all leadership is temporary, there is going to come a time where what we're doing on this earth, our part of it, comes to an end. And it's important for us to think in really calculating terms about our life. And however much our life we have, we don't know the answer to that. But we're called at the same time to think from the standpoint of the end. That we don't just think in terms of what am I going to do today and what am I going to do tomorrow and so forth, but the Christian life is a goal-centered life. Paul called it finishing the course. as he's writing his final words to his disciple Timothy in 2 Timothy 4. I finished the course, he says. There is a course that we are all on, all of us, and it is critical that we don't waste our lives. It's critical that before God, we begin to think in terms of what is the end toward which I believe the Lord is calling me. And this is something that we see in this narrative with Elijah and Elisha. The passing of the mantle is a fresh opportunity now for Elisha to say, okay, what about it? Look, every generation has to face its own challenges. And I remember, you know, as my generation was coming into leadership in this fellowship, and now that's been over 40 years ago. It's been a long time. And some of us here tonight remember those days well. The question that was on our minds was really a question that was posed originally to me, to my thinking at least, by the writer and apologist Francis Schaeffer, who asks this penetrating question. He says, what does it mean to authentically represent Jesus Christ in this generation? In this generation. You know, generations before had their challenge, and now you have this challenge. And so, to my younger friends, I put to you this evening, what is the challenge that your generation faces to be a living witness for Jesus Christ, to make the reality of the living God known to the world around you? That is the key question that you must answer. Specifically, we're asking a couple things. One, we're asking, how do we speak to the legitimate longings of the lost people in this generation? You know, cultures change. The truth about God never changes. And what's wrong with humanity, our alienation from God, the brokenness that is just absolutely a part of universal human experience, it's our condition before God. That doesn't change. But how we experience God, how we experience the brokenness of the world around us, that does change. And the issues that we face from one generation to another are somewhat different. And so this is an important question for us to really kind of be able to think through a bit. Specifically, I'm asking a few things. I'm asking, first, how do your peers think about spiritual things? The answer that you get today is going to be significantly different than the answer of 40 years ago. It just is. Can you engage in open, gracious exploration of spiritual topics with your peers, with people who are far from God, who are living the kind of life that you live, in your life situation? What are those questions that come to mind? I think that everybody in our culture has some sort of a spiritual set of beliefs. They're probably a hodgepodge of all kinds of things. Often we're not really very in touch with them. But what are those things that animate the emerging generation's thoughts about God? And do you have the ability to recognize them and in a gracious and clarifying way speak to them? That's your responsibility, my friends. That's what we must do. Each of us to our generation must be able to answer those deep and probing questions. There are legitimate longings that lost people have, because whether they acknowledge God or not, all human beings are in the image of God. And for this reason, there is always, always, always common ground. There's always a place to connect. There's always a place to talk. And it is the responsibility of every generation to ferret that out and to say, where are those flashpoints where I can connect with my neighbor, with that person in the cubicle next to mine, or whatever it might be? How would you characterize the lostness of your peers? What feelings does that evoke in you? Now, why am I asking this question? Who cares how you feel? They care how you feel. Because the ability to resonate and to connect with and to feel the brokenness of lost people is a prerequisite to our ability to compassionately, sympathetically, and authentically connect on a deep and spiritual level in a way that people who may believe things that are vastly different than you as a biblical Christian sense there's something real about you and genuine in what you're and how you're engaging them. You know, if we're not struck by the lostness of the world, if it doesn't affect us in a visceral way, how can we really be close to the living God who came and died for them? So there is that need, and I think that sometimes it's true that cultures drift, and our culture's been drifting for a long time. And the distance between where we are as biblically minded Christians and the way that our culture thinks has gotten further and further apart. I think that that's absolutely true. But what enables us to make connection, that is a felt connection, is that we are able to sense and be affected by the brokenness of our day and not insulated from it, which is easy to happen because the further you get from culture, the more closely we kind of connect with our own little subgroup, whatever that is, whether that's a Christian subculture or whatever kind of subculture, and we're more distant from the other and more comfortable in our own world, and we sense, we feel the distance that is there. And yet the example of Jesus is that he moved toward people. And Elisha is on a life-long quest at this point to connect with people all over Israel in a new day with new circumstances coming that were not envisioned by Elijah. And we have to have the same sort of thing, that compassion and the care and the courage to move towards broken people. Where are there windows for the gospel today? Where are those touch points? Where is there real common ground where we can connect with the noble aspirations of lost people and to be able to point toward Jesus Christ in the light of them? Those are not just abstract questions. In a certain sense, they are. They're deep kind of meaning-oriented questions, aren't they? But all human beings are motivated by these kinds of things, and it is our job to move toward people in this way. Then, too, every generation faces its own challenge, not just in terms of how to speak to the culture, but how to live before the watching world. To live in such a way that it draws attention to the reality of Christ. What do you think are the practical priorities to demonstrate the reality of Christ today? And so that's an important question. What does it look like in your family life? What does it look like as an emphasis to your own personal life and the communal life and witness of your home church to live out something that really says to neighbors and friends, you know, there's something real going on here, something that deeply touches my most significant aspirations. And what I want is what I see in them. And I think that the vast majority of us here this evening, whether we remember that or not, recognize that our first exposure to the Christian community spoke powerfully to us. It wasn't just the words that we heard. It was something that we saw in the way that they related to one another, a bond, a love, an affection. A real community, not a fake community. And we longed for that, and we wanted that. And every generation has to be the ones who, for their generation, demonstrates the reality of God through how we live together. How is your part of the prophetic presence of the world going? You know, how do you play a role in that? That's a question that you need to answer before God. That is central to your calling in this world. Second, there's a confidence issue underlying this passage and connected to the Spirit. Elisha asks for a double portion of the spirit of Elijah. In the Old Testament, before Christ came, before he died and was resurrected, the Spirit of God did not come and permanently abide in all of God's people and people who truly believed, because Christ had not yet paid for the sins of humanity. And so the Spirit came upon people throughout the Old Testament to have a living connection with God, to be his mouthpiece, to effect work on God's behalf. And it was that Elisha was drawn to. And it was that he saw lacking in himself. And so that is the thing that more than anything Elisha wanted from Elijah, is a spirit that is more than personality, that is more than talent and everything else, that is about God working in and through. Expertise and commitment are necessary to do the work of God. You know, they spent 10 years together. My guess is that Elisha learned a lot from this older prophet. A lot about how to engage people who are representatives of an unrighteous government. How to engage people who are complacent and refuse to acknowledge the one true God. There are a whole range of people that they are interacting with, and the skill of taking what God has revealed in his word and then poignantly and effectively communicating that, that is a skill that has to be developed. But it's not enough. It's insufficient. I really like the way that Ronald Wallace puts it in his little comparison of Elijah and Elisha. He says, noting on this passage, he says, in spite of our weaknesses and our inadequacy for the task of God in our generation, the same mighty Spirit which has fitted trembling men as weak as ourselves to great tasks can fit us today. The Christian life is a result of an inward miracle. I sort of like that a lot, what he's saying there. And what he's recognizing is, though it's true of, I think, anyone who honestly says, I want my life to count for God and I'm going to be involved in the things that God is involved with, which is that you sense your deep inadequacy. Or I hope you do, because you are. And so instead, what we need to be saying is, Lord, it's your Spirit that I want to learn to trust and rely on so that he might manifest Christ through me. That's really what we're talking about here. The marks of the Spirit in our work kind of follow along pretty predictable lines as the Bible describes them. First, by an unusual boldness and clarity. A lot of us are super timid. Some of us are maybe garish and outrageous and brash and obnoxious. But the other 99% of us are not, right? Most of us sense the danger of the moment more than the opportunity. And it is the Spirit who prompts us and provides the wisdom and the impetus to appropriately and forcefully represent Jesus Christ. I really like the way Peter is described both in the Gospels and in the early chapters of the book of Acts. We know how timid Peter was. He denied Christ his face 3 times and so forth. But we also learn in Acts chapter 4 that he was filled with the Holy Spirit. And Peter declared in front of all of the rulers of Israel, the elders of the people, he said, let it be known to all of you and to all the people of Israel that by the name of Jesus Christ, the Nazarene, whom you crucified, whom God resurrected, there is salvation in no one else, for there is no other name under heaven by which we must be saved. And it says of those who were listening to him to speak in this powerful way, he said they observed the confidence of Peter and John and understood that they were uneducated men. Yet they were amazed and began to recognize that they had been with Jesus. And so here would be something very specific, I think, for all of us to really think about here. Namely, Lord, give me a double portion of your Spirit. Let me be full of your Spirit. To be filled with the Spirit is something God is eager to do. And in being full of the Spirit gives us a boldness and a clarity about what's really at stake. And so we're able to speak beyond what I think we would maybe feel comfortable with, but not in a self-promoting way, but in a Spirit-led sort of way. And so I think that one of the things that we have to ask ourselves in a practical sense here is, do we find that we are able to be in places where we are just able to take risks and to communicate with forcefulness and clarity beyond our ability? Because that is what the Spirit of God intends to do in us and through us. We find as well that the Spirit of God, as we allow Him to work, fill our lives, produces an effect, a love and a sensitivity that is palpable even to the sense of smell. It's sort of a metaphor. 2 Corinthians chapter 2, Paul says it like this. He says, "Thanks be to God who always leads us in triumph in Christ and manifests through us the sweet aroma of the knowledge of Him in every place." You know, it's just that sense that when people are drawing our lives from the Spirit, and when we are placing ourselves before God as agents of His to be used however He wants, and He has His way in our life, and our lives are being affected by the Spirit of God, that there is something that people sense, a changed life. It's not weird, but it's engaging, and it's beautiful, and it's the sense that I really would like to have what this guy has. And that's what God seeks to accomplish in your life. As His witness, there is a place for vision and sacrifice. The Spirit of God helps us to just recognize the importance of the moment and to cultivate that sharpness and that clarity of vision and in the light of that, the willingness to sacrifice. That is one clear indication of a spiritually vital Christian, is that ongoing pervasive sense of vision and purpose and the willingness on an ongoing way to make decisions in our lives, in our personal lives, in our social lives, in our professional lives, in our family lives, to make ourselves available to that vision. Peter came to a very poignant moment in his life in John chapter 6 that kind of illustrates this. Jesus says that many of His disciples were no longer walking with Him. They were like, this is too weird. And Jesus said to the 12, "You do not want to go away also, do you? Here's the door, my friends." But Simon Peter answered, and he said, "Lord, to whom shall we go? You alone have the words of eternal life. We believe and have come to know that you are the Holy One of God." There's no plan B, like we were talking about last week. What could there possibly be as a plan B if Jesus is the Holy One of God, the Messiah, awaited by all who are far from Him? What possible plan B could there be? "Only you," He says, "have the word of eternal life." And in seeing that with personal and poignant clarity, Peter, with all of his failings, and so many failings yet to come before, after this incident, is like, "I'm in, I'm ready to go." And when we are in and ready to go, the Spirit of God is like, "Okay, we all agree. And now I'm going to be able to use you forcefully and effectively in this world." Third, There is a continuity in God's work that is interesting here. There's this incident where Elijah takes Elisha. They go down to the Jordan River, and Elijah puts his tunic in the river, and the river parts. And we're like, that's a weird detail. Why is that there? Well, there's a reason, actually, why that's there, and it has to do with Elijah teaching Elisha a lesson from the past. Because there is a continuity to God's work. Every generation takes on a new role. There's a new challenge, but it is always in keeping with the kinds of challenges that have always been a part of the work of God in this world. And so, what Elijah is trying to show Elisha is that God is faithful to his word. And here's how it goes. This event of parting the Jordan River, this is not the first time that's happened. We go all the way back to the book of Joshua, chapter 1. And there's this interaction between God and Joshua that's sort of poignant. It says in Joshua 1, in verse 5, God promises Joshua, he says, I'm going to, just as I was with Moses, so I will be with you, and I will not fail you or forsake you. I want you to know that all that you saw from your mentor, Moses, God is going to affect his own thing through you that will be just as powerful, just as significant to my work in the world. And so for that reason, because I'm with you and because we have work to do together, you, on your side, be strong and courageous, trusting in the power of God. And then it says, when the priests of the priests' feet, who are with Joshua, rested in the waters of the Jordan, the waters of the Jordan were cut off. In other words, they parted. And for Joshua, it was like, you've seen that before. And it's just a playback to when God through Moses parted the Red Sea and the people walked on through. It was an act of deliverance that God gave to his people. And now what God is saying to Joshua is, I'm going to be with you just like I was with Moses, and this exodus from Egypt and this forming of this great nation, this is an ongoing project, and I'm going to show you in the same way that I'm with you. Just as I was with Moses. And so the waters are parted and the people go from one side of the Jordan River and then into the interior of the ground that they were to take for to live in. The event at the Jordan River shows that this the same God with the same care and the same work that God had for Joshua as he did for Moses. And so now here's Elijah. And he's basically wanting to teach his buddy Elisha the same lesson. Look, we can be strong and courageous because God's been around the block a bunch of times on these things. And so in repeating this miraculous event, it's carrying over the idea that just as God was calling on Joshua to be strong and courageous, just as Elijah learned how to be strong and courageous, just as Elijah was trying to train Elisha to be strong and courageous, why? Because we can trust the power of God, because he is with those whom he calls. He's with them. Same power, same plan. So it's important then for us to become aware, as Elisha was, that yes, that same God that was with Elijah is with me. That just as Elijah parted the waters, so then at the end of the story, Elisha also parts the waters to demonstrate to those who are looking on that yes, God is with him just as he was with Elijah. And that your faithfulness is going to be tested. You will come to places in your life of seeking to serve Christ where you realize I'm not strong and courageous, where I don't have the answers that I want to have, where I feel mired down by competing interests. I feel overwhelmed by the burden of what is around me, and I just don't have what it takes. And this is where God says, okay, you're right, in part, because you don't. But be strong and courageous, because I do. So a lot of us here tonight, in our own way, are fighting our own little battle with God. We wonder, can God be trusted? I've made a life for myself. I'm comfortable. I can live in it. But I realize at the same time that God is calling me to something greater. He's calling me across the river. He's calling on me to do something that is risky, that is dangerous, that will involve rejection, that will involve sacrifice and adversity. How do we know that? Because we've seen it in the lives of others and we're just not so sure. Do you know what I mean? I think you know what I mean. Do I have the humility to put the interests and the needs, the concerns of others above myself, my will, my way, and to serve them sacrificially and wholeheartedly? Now we're just, bam, we're up against our limitations. And it's in this context that we evoke the memory of all of those who have gone before us, and to recognize that God knows the limitations of all of his servants and will bring us to the end of our limit of our ability and beyond. Because it's only in that place where the dial on your dashboard is now in the red zone and you're thinking, oh my God, that's where God manifests himself. When you're in danger, when you're in your over your head, that's where we find that we can rely on a powerful and caring God. Don't hold on to what's secure. Move forward. Last, the community of servants. And so this is kind of a cool place, I think, to end. Because if you read in a casual way the story of Elijah and Elisha, you will think, as Elijah himself said three times in 1 Kings chapters 18 and 19, I'm in it by myself. I'm all alone. And yet that wasn't the case, and it's never the case. And the reality is that there's a whole community of people that God calls us to live out our vision and our purpose and our ministry alongside. There are no lone wolves. I thought it was lone wolves. And I was corrected by the tech crew. They're like, that's not a word. I'm like, sure it is. It's the plural of wolf. They're like, no, it's a verb about eating too much, too fast. And I'm like, that's crazy. That's ridiculous. That's a colloquialism. So they bring up the Oxford English Dictionary, and there I am, just slain. I'm wrong. It's wolves. Unless your name is Wolf. Then you can be a lone wolf. Could you be both a lone wolf and a lone wolves? It's a very complicated and deep question. For the rest of us, there are no lone wolves. Because that's just not the way God set things up. You may feel like you're alone, but you're not alone. You're not alone at all. There is this whole community of prophets that Elijah and Elisha are connected to this whole time. That's why on the last day of his life, Elijah goes from Gilgal to Bethel to Jericho, and he's saying goodbye to these scores and scores of people that they have done life together with, that they've cared about. Prophetic ministry operates in a culture of consensus. And I think that's an important thing. We have in our hyper-individualistic culture kind of reduced the idea of God's calling and God's purpose in our life to God's purpose and calling for me. And the way that the Bible describes it, it's not a we, it's a me, it's a we. Okay, I find a unique purpose and calling from God. That's true, but in the context of the we that we are. And indeed, our ability, I think, to hear effectively from him is rooted in our connectedness to that broader culture of which we have been made a part. And so here comes to sort of this last issue that I think we need to consider here, and which is, you know, are we in a place in our relationships with our Christian friends in our home church, for instance, where we're having those kinds of discussions, where they're seeing our lives and how we are responding to the Spirit of God in our lives and so forth, where we can actually together sort of affirm that God is at work, that there is a work for us all to do, and that, yes, we believe that God has called you to this part in that role. You know, what Elisha was going to be doing over these next many chapters and what Elijah had done before was incredibly important, but was never enough. Okay, so he wins this big competition with the prophets of Baal on Mount Carmel. But if there aren't scores and scores and scores of other people who are all in for God and who are following up with all of these people to say, did you see God act? What are we going to do with that? Let me instruct. Let me encourage and admonish you. Let's form community together. See, without that, what Elijah and Elisha and any prophet does is of just very kind of in-the-moment value. It has been said that Billy Graham has brought into the millions of people into a living relationship with Jesus Christ. And that may or may not be true. One thing we definitely do know based upon Graham Organization's own studies is that a very, very small percentage of those people 2 years later are involved in any kind of Christian fellowship. The work of God is not just the public, obvious individual. It's the community of people who are engaged relationally, who are fighting out with others for the real faith of God, faith in God, faith in Christ. That's really what it takes. And so I just want to encourage us as we close here that there is a calling on your life that is awesome. There is a power to sustain the calling of God in your life and to affect it through you in the Spirit of God. There are the examples of many who have gone before you that we can learn from and so forth. But in the present moment, the real question that we're going to have to ask ourselves is, am I significantly, authentically, and intimately connected with a body of believers in Jesus Christ that we can together affect the things of God? Because it's not going to happen while we're just out there on our own. But when we have these four pieces together, these are the components that we're going to consistently see in the life of Elisha going forward as God affects, even for a moment of time, a moment in time, an important moment in time, real transformation in Israel's society. So that's all I've got on that.
This study was recorded at Zenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.